Hey y'all, so three quick things. The first is that this episode says episode 109 in the actual audio. It's actually episode 110. This was my mistake. I had some computer troubles a couple weeks ago, and I forgot about this particular recording. So it's actually 110, and yeah. So the other thing, of course, is if you want to support this show, you can easily do that at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty. Sign up for a one-month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. They have lots of cool stuff up there that you can enjoy, lots of science fiction, fantasy. You get a free audiobook, and you help us. And if you don't want to keep the service, that's cool, although Audible is pretty awesome. So, and then the third thing is I'm still running my Fund a Laptop project. It ends this Wednesday. I'm pretty darn close, but obviously no cigar quite yet. A lot of people have been really helpful, and I appreciate that. So if you want to help, you can donate $10, get lots of free stuff. There's also a funny video of me doing like ghetto Captain America, which you can enjoy. There'll be a link in the show notes for that if you want to help out. So thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 109.
An interview with Jennifer Pelland.
It's not an interview, it's a discussion.
A discussion with Jennifer Pelland.
Get it right, man. It's slightly different.
All right, hey, you pronounced my name right, so I'm just thrilled.
So obviously, this is a discussion with Jennifer Pelland and Paul Weimer. I've said his name right now. Even though it's inappropriate, it should be Weimer, because it's a German name. But this is our discussion episode in which we are talking about whether or not we think science fiction has in some way impacted the way we think about issues related to the post-human, inhuman, the alien, those kinds of questions. Whether or not in some way it's preparing us for that future. So I guess I kind of wanted to actually start off with you, Jennifer, which is to talk about your book, Machine, which obviously has just come out. And would you maybe tell us a little bit about this book?
Sure. It's the story of a woman who develops early onset Alzheimer's and is able to petition to be put into a android medical replacement body until they can cure her flesh body. So she has all her memories downloaded into this body, which is a perfect copy. Except her wife decides that she doesn't like the idea of being married to someone who's in two bodies at once, freaks her out, and she leaves her. And so the protagonist, Celia, thinks, well, I'm a machine. Why do I have to feel all this stupid meat pain? And falls in with a group of people who illegally hack their bodies to be more mechanical or to be superhuman or whatever it is that they want to do, which is, of course, illegal in the world of this book, because if it weren't, there'd be no plot. So so it's all about, her story is about sort of a woman falling apart while living in this transhuman body. But the world around her is filled with people who are either struggling with the idea of these bodies or embracing it, or it, you know, I tried to play with all the different ways I thought people would look at these, the thought of being able to get a better body if you had the means, and looking at the way people, you know, some people would go nuts with them because they're like, this is fun, and other people would go nuts with them because they didn't want to be a person anymore. So, and hopefully everything in between. So that's the important part for today's discussion about the novel.
Okay. What was kind of the impetus for this narrative? And what initially made you think, I want to have somebody who can augment their body in the most extreme ways to the point, as you said, to make them not even human anymore?
Well, Well, it started out as a short story idea, like pretty much everything in mine, because I'm not generally a novelist. And I started, you know, I just had the idea of someone being put into this medical replacement body and their spouse not being able to handle it. And just all the little, okay, well then, oh, but then, ooh, but then that means, I just kept spinning out farther and farther all the implications that could possibly go with this and all the things this person could possibly go through. So I just suddenly realized I had a novel. So it was just me playing with the, you know, watching the dominoes fall the more I thought about the implications of it. So it was just this tiny little idea that just the more I thought about it, the bigger it got.
Okay, so that leads us really to our major question then. And I guess we could start by just actually coming up with an answer to that question. And then I have other kind of discussion points that might come up. But what do we think? Do we think that science fiction is somehow preparing us for a post-human future? Whether or not that's the intention of science fiction is, I don't think, necessarily relevant. But whether or not we get a sense that that's what science fiction is doing. So why don't we get Paul in, because he hasn't said anything yet. What do you think, Paul?
I do think that science fiction has been seminal in preparing not only the science fiction community, but the wider community of readers and people in general for the idea of machine intelligences, post-human intelligences, augmented humans. It's that whole climb towards the theoretical singularity first articulated in full by Werner Vinge in the 80s, but even so, even with predecessors going all the way back to the 50s with stories like A Logic Named Joe. So science fiction has been slowly building our tolerance and our acceptance of that this might happen for a very long time. Now, in the last 10, 20 years, it's not only building up the idea of the singularity and of post-human artificial intelligence and these issues, but the ethics, the concerns, the problems, such as in Jennifer's book, as in Madeline Ashby's book, as in the work of Charles Strauss, what would this actually look like if it actually happened, and what are the ramifications in engaging in a more direct fashion rather than like, oh yes, now we have artificial intelligence, la la la. What does that really mean? And science fiction is bringing these issues to the public.
Okay.
See, I would argue, though, that the public in general are not science fiction readers. I think science fiction media is doing that. And I don't think it does necessarily as good a job as the literature, but it's really the movies and the TV shows that are impinging upon the general public's consciousness. And unfortunately, a lot of that is geared towards horror, which is not to say that horror is unfortunate. It just means sort of puts more fear in people about things than they necessarily might need to have. I actually think, though, for some of this post-humanism, at least for augmenting, right now what's really pushing it more into consciousness is medical technology for disabled war vets.
Yeah.
I think, sadly, as usual, you know, war is giving us the future in this weird way. That the technology that we're developing so that these people who have these catastrophic injuries can have functioning limbs again or something like them, the work that's being done to link non-functioning eyeballs directly to the brain so that you can actually see something, not much yet, but a lot of this is coming through disabled war vets lately, and that's something that I think one of the reasons why it's working well is because it's something everyone can get behind. It's not this dystopian future of Terminators. It's, hey, these people fought a war that our government sent them to, and now we're trying to fix them. So it's sad that it took that, I think, but I'm, you know, it's something that we can get behind our government putting money into, for instance, whereas we wouldn't do it for just pure research purposes.
Yeah, and I do kind of agree with you there that the if we look at the media that's being presented, it is not the kind of picture that Paul was painting. Most of the movies are, you know, things that have gone bad. I mean, I think of the most recent robot-related movies are iRobot, in which things go very bad, or you think like District 9, where things go bad in the opposite direction, where humans treat aliens as particularly nasty. And I'm trying to think of any movies we've watched in which there is a sort of positive, or even just like an attempt to kind of deal with what do we deal with on a day-to-day basis with these kinds of changes, even just like body modifications. And I'm not sure I'm seeing that. The only thing I can think of is there was a show called Total Recall 2070, which is not actually based on Total Recall so much as like a mishmash of Total Recall and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, in which one of the main characters is actually a new class of android, and it's the show deals with sort of a cop drama in which they have to deal with actual problems with androids and the fact that this guy just found out that his partner is an android, this new class of android. So, but there isn't a lot of media that's dealing with that. And the literature, though, is really asking a lot of the big questions. But as you say, people aren't necessarily reading that. And I guess I do also question how much does even the media influence our opinions on things like robots or things like you say, like the soldiers getting, you know, robotic arms and other kinds of augmentations and biomedical kind of things that are being done as well. I'm not even convinced that the darkness of the media necessarily is impacting our view of robotics so much as just making us want to do it more.
What about anime such as Ghost in the Shell? I think that
that's a good example. Yeah,
I think that does bring. I mean, it's not as big as say a blockbuster movie like Prometheus, but it does bring some of these issues out of the realm of literature, which I would argue is the sea that popular media, going all the way back to HAL in 2001, has been drawing from and bringing to the public. But things like that, animes like Ghost in the Shell, are engaging with these issues in a very real and often, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, yes, nuanced way.
Yeah,
almost as well as literature.
Well, this is, I mean, I'm not an anime fan, but I suppose it doesn't surprise me, considering that the Japanese have a much different view of robots than we do. You know, they're making sex robots. They haven't crossed the uncanny valley yet. Actually, they're in the middle of the uncanny valley, but they're much more comfortable with robots than our culture seems to be in the, at least in America. I can't speak for the rest of the West, but yeah, so it's, in a way, it's not surprising that it would be coming out of Japan much more positively than it. I mean, like, the last good android we had that leaps to mind is Data.
There's a good example. Yeah.
Oh, that was Bishop. I can't remember if Bishop, I think Data came second. I can't remember the order of when Alien 2 came out versus TNG.
They may have been all, like, right at the same time, almost.
Right. And then we go back to the android in Prometheus who touches everything. Oh, my God. Only saving grace is that he was played by Michael Fassbender.
Who is quite adorable, yes.
Oh, my God.
But, yeah, no, I didn't really understand that either. Yeah, you're right. And I do, it is very interesting with the Japanese that in Japan, I mean, they even had a mall that had the Asimo robot that would, I mean, he didn't do much. He sat there and greeted people in, presumably in Japanese, and when they walked into the mall, and he just sat there and waved. But in Japan, I guess, like, that would not seem so strange, maybe because their media is, in a lot of senses, very saturated with robot imagery. I mean, if you look at anime, there are robots and, like, modified people, and there's just all kind, that stuff is, it's almost like if an anime doesn't have it, it's a very strange anime in a lot of sense. Maybe that's from my perspective coming from the West, and what comes over here is probably true, but there is that, you're right, that culture is very different than, and it seems like almost that maybe for the Japanese there's almost like a direct engagement with robots, whereas here we don't necessarily have that, like, outside of the people working in the military with, like, exoskeletons, or the people being worked on, as you said, the military figures, and the occasional person who's getting some sort of medical research done on them, we don't really engage. I mean, the only time we engage in this culture is with what we read or what we see on the TV. But, I mean, I couldn't go to the mall. There wouldn't be a robot there. There would be an annoying car that I could possibly win but probably won't win because I can't afford the taxes. But otherwise, you know, yeah.
And then there was also that, I can't remember his name, but it's happened recently, the man who has the camera implanted into his skull, who the employees in a McDonald's in France tried to rip this thing off of his face that is implanted into his skull because they were that threatened by someone walking in who had this machine bit sticking out of his face. They tried to pull it off of him. I do find it a little bit creepy to look at, but that's no reason. There's plenty of things that are creepy to look at. You don't tear them off of people.
And it does hint at some kind of, like, in some sense, this is that moment when suddenly that technology is not something that you can literally rip off of somebody anymore. That suddenly we're in that, we have to start asking the question, is that camera over his eye actually over his eye and, like, strapped on, or is it actually a part of him? And in a very strange way, we're now getting to that sort of situation where the public maybe is occasionally having to face that. And as you say, in France, like, freaked out by it to some extent.
I just looked him up so we can use his name, Dr. Steve Mann.
And it was literally embedded inside of him. Like, it was like, if he pulled it out, he probably would have bled out and died or had something awful happen to him.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's, I feel sorry for that guy in that moment. Good Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Paul, you wanted to chime in a minute ago.
I did. I think that the default view of robots is very different in Japan as versus the rest of the Western world. And the incident of Dr. Mann in France highlights that robots and that sort of high tech augmentation is scary. I think our culture has evolved in a direction where robots are still treated warily, maybe is the right word. I don't know if that has to deal with robots taking jobs away from, say, auto workers, for example, as just resonating with that robots are here to make our lives not good, not better. Whereas in Japan, robots are regarded as something to improve people's lives. Mm. And as we go into augmentations and one day perhaps artificial intelligences, I do think that Japan will stand athwart the rest of the world, and we'll have to see whether or not the Japanese culture and ethos on robots spreads out from Japan, or if the reverse happens.
I suspect, I mean, just given the kind of the way history kind of goes, that even if it doesn't happen immediately, it's going to happen over a very slow period of time, that if Japan becomes that place where we have, like, walking robots everywhere in, like, 50 years, I suspect that the rest of the world is going to look at that and go, well, I guess we're going to have to adapt to this idea. Because otherwise, they'll be the only country without walking robots. And I'm sorry, but you can't really say you're like, the greatest country and manufacturing things, and you can't even make walking robots. It's just kind of, it falls apart.
If we can't have flying cars, we should have robots, right?
I would be okay with that, as long as they're nice robots.
I'm fine with that.
Okay.
If they look like Michael Fassbender, I'll buy 12.
I'm just reminded of the Animatrix and the whole history leading up to the first Matrix movie and the development of AI and how humanity freaks out and bad things happen. Is that our future?
Well, that's really kind of the question is, you know, we've got so many stories in whatever medium in which that is the case. And I wonder if, is the public even thinking, like, you know, maybe we need to think about what we're doing before we just go and do it? Or is it just entertainment and we're just on some sort of sick level obsessed with disaster and doing bad things to other creatures? Because I feel that in some sense the general public is, I think they go to the movies, and most of them, like, they'll watch iRobot and they'll come out and go, that was a cool movie. But they won't think, well, maybe we need to think about these three laws of robotics and make them much more efficient. But that's my sense, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe some of you disagree.
Well, I don't necessarily think people walk out thinking hard about these things, but if you see a bunch of movies about robots bad, it's going to sink in, robots bad, unless you actually stop and think about it. It's just what we get saturated with. You know, cyborgs bad, robots bad. And, you know, we do have some notable examples of the opposite, but a lot of these movies make it out to be a big deal that they're the opposite, like in Aliens, not Alien 2, in Aliens, when Ripley is astonished to find out Bishop is an android and is furious that she's been put on another mission with one because of what happened last time. He's the exception. And that seems to be the case an awful lot. I mean, you know, when we meet Data's brother, he's evil, you know, because he has emotions and he was shut off because he didn't quite work right. And Data is the example of the exception of the, he's different, even though there's only two of them. It's seen as remarkable. And even in iRobot, the fact that there was only one who managed to stay himself when the rest of the robots were being switched over. So we get this idea, this sort of background idea in our heads from this media we take in, that the good robot is the rare robot. Like, you have to reprogram this one Terminator to save John Connor. You had to break him somehow to make him good. And so I don't think people are necessarily going to walk around thinking about that, but that's just what the mass media has given us. That's sort of the broad brush in Western robot portrayals that we tend to get.
Yeah. Paul, did you want to add to that?
I actually wanted to branch off a point that Jennifer made earlier regarding the military, and I do think that the military is going to be the driver for technology, at least from the U.S. perspective, because the military is such a big part of our economy, in the direction of robots and robotic equipment. I don't know if either of you are familiar with the old board game Ogre, done by Steve Jackson back in the 80s, where you basically had humans trying to fight off a giant robot tank. And it's entirely plausible to me that robot tanks are going to be built one day. I mean, look at drones, which are becoming more and more autonomous every day. A robot tank that becomes sentient, yeah, I could see that happening. And then when you see a robot tank rolling across the deserts of Syria, then people will really pay attention when it's unmistakable that robots are here and robots are becoming as capable as humans in some areas, if not more so.
From what I hear from friends of mine who actually study the brain and study computers, this whole idea of sentient machines is very far-fetched. It's very unlikely. It could happen. Things could change in ways that, you know, technology could change in ways that we just can't foresee. But, you know, friends of mine in the know about these subjects said that was really the biggest whopper in the middle of my book, the fact that you could actually have something that you could feel like a human inside something completely artificial. I think as much as I love stories about robots, especially interesting stories about robots, it really does stretch my, it's really getting harder and harder to suspend my disbelief about it. And I just sort of realize I have to put that aside when reading something. I think it's entirely possible that your hypothetical robot tank going rogue would not necessarily be a case of something going sentient. It'd be a case of something like one of the things that crashed on Mars being programmed badly and starting to execute wrong decisions based on if-thens that were programmed into it incorrectly.
But another solution, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But if it's going rogue on its own, it's more likely that something has gone wrong rather than the tank has discovered sentience and it hates humans and just wants love. I'm going to find another sentient tank somewhere. Make little tank babies.
No, that's not what I meant. What I meant was a previously designed as sentient tank deciding to go rogue, not that it bootstraps itself into the singularity, that an intelligence is in the tank and that intelligence decides to act in its own interests rather than the interests of its creator. But I see your point that maybe we are as Vernon Benji put it, stuck in the slow zone, and we can't really have artificial intelligences of the first order that we dreamed of. It would be a sadder world if we couldn't in some ways, because as far as we know, we're the only human-level intelligences on this planet and in the universe, for all we can tell. And I think possibly part of the appeal of robot stories is that humans are lonely and we want somebody else to talk to and get perspective that way.
I get that, but at the same time, the studies we currently are getting about cetacean intelligence and primate intelligence, and the fact that we can barely communicate with these other creatures that actually live on our planet and evolved the same way we did and are made of meat like we are and have meat brains like we do, it makes me wonder how we could hope in a way to communicate with something that doesn't even have a brain that's even remotely wired like ours. We're making something completely, you know, something completely artificial. And so it's I don't know. I think it's just too easy.
Oh, I wonder because I know a lot of research being done into things like artificial intelligence are using some of what we understand about how the human brain works to fashion that. And obviously, even with an artificial intelligence, you have a certain degree to which you're dealing with things that don't happen in the human brain. I mean, AI is dealing with ones and zeros. The human brain is dealing with cells and weird chemicals and brr and all kinds of nonsense. But there is some influence on that, so I wonder if maybe like both of you are wrong and what we'll end up with is like a sentient robotic creature at some point that can talk to us, but we only can half understand each other at any one point in time because we both are slightly off from like we have things in common but kind of off. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just trying to imagine what it must be like to have 100% perfect recall of everything that ever happened, or being able to delete something entirely. I mean, that's so alien to how we work. So I can't imagine it would result in similar thought processes.
Who knows? I mean, we're just going to have to do it now, just to find out.
All right, let's meet in the garage.
All right, let's do it. I don't think any of us are capable, but let's go for it. Just imagining like we're in the garage and we've got like the, you know, the blowtorch and there's just sparks flying everywhere, and then finally the police come and like, what the hell are you guys doing? We're building a robot. No, it's not a robot. You're building something that's gonna kill us all.
Some well, sort of poisonous thing.
Yeah. We'd put an angry face on it just for kicks, I'm sure. I would, but that's me. But anyway, so Jennifer had suggested when we had some technical difficulties that actually we should talk about Cylons, which is really interesting because Cylons are perhaps one of the most iconic examples of robots going sort of wrong but also going sort of right. Now, I'm assuming by Cylons you mean the new Battlestar, not the old Battlestar?
I do, because I think it plays more into the whole transhumanism discussion than the original, because these are not just, you know, I'm not just talking about the toasters. I'm talking about the ones who actually are made of flesh but are artificial creations.
Okay, yeah, and I think they're really interesting because they, like you said, they do actually bring up these questions of cyborgs or and sort of biological machines, because that's essentially what they are in Battlestar. And I think Battlestar in some ways was attempting to deal with the very questions we keep raising, which is what does a machine-ish intelligence think? Or how does it think? How does it view the world? And obviously, I mean, there's still the problem of they created these creatures that are still thinking in very human ways, but in some ways are still thinking very differently than most humans, I think, would think.
And they also... Go
Are
ahead.
Are we going to spoil Battlestar Galactica? We could
it's been off the air for how many years?
Okay.
All right, well, okay, spoiler. If you have never seen the new Battlestar, don't listen past this point. Go.
Okay, well, we do learn that most of the humaniform Cylons are from a different iteration of humanity creating them. And they are instrumental in the creation of the toasters, as it was put earlier. So there's whole ethics of are the Cylons trying to create their own legacy through humans? That, and not to mention the whole tangled web of opinions and goals on part of the Cylons. It does seem very human in some ways, more almost maybe too human in their feuding and their tangled goals. But for all of the show's flaws, I do think it does show that machine intelligence is as something other than monolithic. I think it really captured that they can have squabbles and disagreements even if they're not human themselves.
And in a way, they also have disagreements with themselves. There are multiple iterations of the same model. And I found that fascinating, that, you know, the what it meant about identity. If you're all a six, but you're different sixes, but the sixes have a certain thing in common that makes them a six, but you can have differing opinions about being a six. You know, the fact that at one point they took a vote and I think the eight split.
Yeah, and the eight one split of the eight down the middle. Yeah.
Right. And you can box a model. The whole thought of being able to basically continue to live, to do something, to be more daring because you know you can be downloaded again and you don't have the limitations of the flesh that someone who when they die has. I mean, in a way, they're kind of like the flip side of replicants from Blade Runner, where they're also created by humans for humans, but they have a really short expiration date. It's like taking the same idea, but that one little piece of being able to essentially live forever versus having a tiny lifespan makes such a huge difference in how you would have to think. You know, how you plan your life, if you're trying to cram everything as possible into 5 little years versus knowing that so long as the resurrection ship's out there, you're going on forever. That neither of them could possibly think like a human being, because we have completely different, we're all bringing different sets of limitations.
Yeah, it is interesting that question of identity for Battlestar, in particular because it is, in the show, it is such a shock when one of the Cylons breaks with its model and it doesn't side with the rest of, like what you said, with the eights. The Sharon model, the Boomer model, actually breaks with her eight, the rest of the eights, to break the tie between them all. This is, I think, after they box the Deannas. So, and it's this shocking moment, like, this has never happened in the history of Cylons that anyone has broken with their model. And it is sort of like this question of, you know, all of the models do sort of develop a little bit of their own individuality, but it is that moment when they cease to go along with consensus that we see that this sort of this new identity being formed, and that for the Cylons is the threat, whereas opposed for the humans, the threat is the fact that the Cylons can think for themselves. And that for us is the terrifying thing, this thing we created can think for itself. Also, the fact that the Cylons look like us, so you have the Uncanny Valley problem, which is kind of slightly terrifying, actually, when you think about it. Particularly also terrifying that half of the Cylons are really attractive women who have a tendency to walk around in, I'm going to just say, this relatively attractive clothing. Well thought out. Very well thought out on their part, like very heavily patriarchal society, really smart. Go for hot women and get the men that way. It's intelligent. That's why they won. It wasn't just because they had nukes. They were smart.
So that was intelligent design, which, you know,
you did apparently just go there.
Yeah, you know, it works when you actually make something yourself.
This is true. This is really true. Yeah,
it's fair.
Fair.
Paul, you wanted to add something to this. I know you were waiting.
No, actually, I didn't have that big of a point, but I do agree that the Cylons show subtlety as well as strength in their design, how they portray themselves to appeal to the humans, and it becomes like it's like that looking into the mirror again. Humans looking at Cylons, Cylons looking at humans, the whole interbreeding thing. It's almost as if machine and human intelligence are trying to grow towards each other, not always in a positive symbiotic way, but they are their fates are entangled, shall we say, whether they like it or not. And it just seems the show just pushes them in each other's arms, and how they deal with that, whether they will it or not, is a big part of the show's themes. And this does go back to the point of, this does show the general public how this may eventually play out if we do actually can create AIs of that level, or just in general, just the whole idea of augmented humans or humans beyond the flesh and skin that we know of. Just give another example, the Olympic runner who has the carbon fiber legs that allow him to compete.
When is he competing, by the way?
track and field will have long since gone, I think, by the time this episode is aired, but soon. I was listening to a news program where they're talking, he doesn't, as currently designed, he doesn't have immense advantages. There are disadvantages to having artificial legs, but maybe 5, 10, 15 years, they would be an actual overall advantage rather than the mixed blessing they are now, for lack of a better phrase.
My really big question about that is, how do they determine what does and does not give him an advantage? I mean, because one aspect of the Olympics is this. I mean, I was just watching today, and they made a big deal earlier about one of the Chinese swimmers. They said that she swam too well, so she might have cheated by taking drugs. And then just earlier today, when this is a Wednesday when we're recording, so earlier today, somebody broke, I forget who broke a record. One of the American swimmers broke a record for swimming. And so I guess my question is, since a part of the Olympics is, of course, it's not just getting the gold medal and beating your opponents, but it's also partly to break records, at what point do we even, how do we even determine that somebody has given too much of an advantage from a mechanical augmentation of any sort?
Jennifer?
I'm sure the IIOC will figure out a way. They're already busy finding new and exciting ways to gender test women, so I'm sure they'll come up with something. No one gender tests men.
How do you gender test a... I don't understand that.
Sex is more complicated. Biological sex is much more complicated than most people realize. And you can be externally female and have internally male bits. You can be have an X chromosome and a Y chromosome and look like a woman. You can be a mosaic. There are so many ways of being male, female, both, in between, neither. And there is this thought that if you're a woman and there's something even vaguely male about you biologically, it gives you an advantage. And science is actually starting to show that no, testosterone isn't necessarily going to make you a better athlete, but somehow people are terrified by the specter of a woman who might actually have, like, I've had at least one friend who was externally female and internally male. She even had a kid. She had some of both, and this happens way more than most people realize. Like, you'll find inside someone when you've, you know, a little buried testes inside a woman's body because she's a mosaic of some sort. Super common. Happens to men too, but no one cares about that when men are competing.
I do.
But only
insofar as I don't give a crap if a female athlete has buried testes. I just don't really care.
But there was this this runner from somewhere in Africa who her name's not going to come to me because it's just not a name that I can even pronounce. But she had to go through extensive gender testing after blowing competition away at, I don't know if it was the last Olympics or some other sort of major competition a few years back, because people were looking at her and going, she just looks like a guy. I mean, she's flat chested, small hipped, very muscular, and she is female. But people questioned that, and she had to go through extensive medical tests to keep her medal.
It's
ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. And my just to kind of be slightly contrarian, I can understand to a certain extent, like, there are some natural differences between men and women that means that, like, you know, certain fields, men and women can't compete because there are natural advantages for men in certain fields and vice versa. For, I mean, you just look at the women's teams. The women's teams for gymnastics are astonishing in terms of the kinds of things that they've been able to do, whereas the U.S. men's team, not so astonishing, although still quite good. But that's not really what my point. My point is like, if there are those differences, how do we even come up with, like, at what point do we say, wait, that person might be faking being a woman, or that person might be faking being a man, or I don't understand the protocol. The social protocol for that seems to me like, I don't think there's any possible way for you to do that without being offensive.
Well, I think what happened, if I remember the history, is there actually were examples in Olympic Games, like in the 40s and 50s, of some countries would actually sneak men into women's competitions. And some of them would have had some rudimentary surgery, and I don't know if they all did. But because some countries actually attempted to cheat that way, and it may even be apocryphal, but I think it's true. Now everyone suddenly got extremely exercised about, oh no, we could be sneaking men into things in ways where they don't even realize they're men being snuck into games. I mean, it's ludicrous. But this all feeds into the whole issue of gender and sex both being far more complicated than two.
Right. There's no such thing as a two. There's like 8,000.
It's ridiculous.
It's really complicated.
That's probably a whole other podcast.
Yeah, it is. And but it's all kind of tying into these questions of, even though, like, questions about gender are not necessarily questions about the post-human, there's still questions about what the post-human brings up, which is what is the human condition? I mean, when we think of the genders, we usually think of two genders as though that's somehow all the genders, even though on some level we're all acknowledged that there are other situations, there's, you know, mixes, etc. But even with, like, the post-human, like, you know, the question becomes, at what point does someone cease to be human and become whatever is after human, inhuman, non-human, whatever? And then that brings us back to the fellow with the
carbon fiber legs.
Right, the carbon fiber legs. It brings us back to our, you know, the military question. I mean, is a soldier who comes back who has lost all of his limbs and gets robotic replacements, is he still human? I would say yes in that case, but I mean, again, we could keep going further and further. At what point does that soldier cease to be a human being? What defines the human being? And I don't know if we'll be able to ever answer that question in a single podcast, but
right. I mean, for me, the dividing line when I try to think of things like that is the brain. Mm-hmm. You know, did you start out, or even not even necessarily that, did you start out as a human being? Were you created as a, were you born? And you could change that to, were you decanted or whatever, but, you know, did you start out life as a biological organism? Did you grow up with a human brain? If the rest of you is replaced, but you grew up with a human brain and you maybe even still have one, I still see someone as being human. I start finding that gets fuzzy in my head when I think about, well, what happens if you can copy the contents of a human mind into a machine?
Or what if you could grow a brain?
Right.
I guess theoretically possible. We can grow ears and all kinds of weird stuff on rats.
Your brain's a little more complicated.
Well, obviously. But yeah. I'm saying, like, we've gone to the point where we can grow body parts on other animals, and we can even grow body parts on people now. And maybe it is possible we could grow a brain, but with sticking that brain into some sort of robotic apparatus, would that make that a human being?
I don't know.
That's a question that, again, to our topic, science fiction will probably ask that question, or has asked that question, and tried to puzzle out the answer.
I'm just reminded of the Frederick Pohl story, Day Million. I don't know if either of you have ever read it. It's back from the 50s. And it's a look at life about 1,000 years from now, and you have people who have biologically different genders than their actual genes. They have strange features, augmentations, very strange ethos and lifestyle. And basically the story's point is, yes, these people are still human. Even if they don't look human to you, they are still human because, and the story puts this thing in the tale, how would you look with your 20th century at the time, now 21st century lifestyle, how would you look to, say, Tiglath-Pileser or Attila the Hun as far as being human and as far as what you do? We would look inhuman to people 2,000 years ago in many ways.
Because of the way we dress and what we carry around with us, I'm pretty sure we'd freak out Attila the Hun.
Well, technology and medicine has also changed our society hugely, even recently. The birth control pill has made a massive difference in opportunities for women. Not just a birth control pill, but all forms of you know, safe, easy-to-use contraception. Changed lives for women, period. Women getting control of their own fertility has made a huge difference in what we can do in the workforce. Just having control of our bodies, it's a big deal. And so I would look strange to someone from 200 years ago. Now, just imagine, you know, as things go forward, what sorts of things, it doesn't even have to be transhuman, but just something that we can't even imagine now, what it will do to society in 200 years from now. What sort of things will it open up us? If we don't have to do manual labor anymore because we've all got robots and we're all just, you know, living the Star Trek life of, you know, replicators and no one needs money, that's a huge change. I don't know if we're, I don't think we're going to get there, but something could come along that will completely change what it means to be human, and it might not be something like robotics.
Yeah, I mean, even just do you think of culture? I mean, good lord, if I mean, there are these funny videos on YouTube where, are you guys familiar with Skrillex?
No.
Okay, he's a musician, electronic musician, and he does a particular style called dubstep, and there are these videos where people will get elderly people and have them listen to this music. You know, people from who grew up in the 40s and 50s, you know, were listening to a very different style of music, and have them listen to this music and get their reactions. I mean, just imagine, that's only, you know, 60-year gap for these people in the development of music. Imagine for us, you know, another 60 years, what will music sound like?
I already feel that way about Katy Perry, so, you know. Grunge forever, man.
Oh, no. No.
Hey, I still have my ticket stub from when I saw Nirvana, okay? It's a cherished possession.
Oh, okay. I'm not going to go there.
And suddenly the interview ends.
No, but it again, I mean, you've had this shift, I mean, in the music that you grew up on or that you found to be maybe a defining moment in your life musically, and then suddenly we've got this very different style. I mean, I'll admit, too, some of the music coming out today, I sometimes feel like an old man because I don't quite get it.
Yep.
But and just imagine, you know, I'm probably going to be on this planet for at least another 5 years. So in 5 years, I don't know what it's going to be like. Paul will probably be here for another 50, but
I don't know. Call me maybe.
No.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
I hate you. I hate you so much right now. That's the song.
I finally
in
heard
head.
That song, and it wasn't as awful as I imagined from everything everyone had been saying. I was expecting this like cloying Barbie world type song. When I heard it, I was like, really? That's it? What's the big deal? But I've been told if I watch the video, I'll get it. And so I'm staying away.
Yeah, the video is a little weird and stalkerish. People compared it to that Friday song. Rebecca.
Yeah, but at least this woman seems to be able to sing.
Fair enough. And let's give poor Rebecca Black a break. anyway, so back to the topic, and we got to kind of close out because we're all running a bit on the long side. I should don't know how to bring it back to our topic now that I think about it. Except that clearly in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, this conversation is probably going to be irrelevant. Because something crazy is going to happen, and we're going to have a whole new conversation about all of this.
The future is never what we imagine.
Science
fiction is always about the time you're writing in, not about the time you're writing about. So, you know, whatever our issues are with robots now, it has nothing to do with what we think the future is going to be. It's all our issues about ourselves right now, about lack of control, about things coming along being better than us, about being replaced. It's got nothing to do with what's actually going to happen. It's all what we're afraid of right now.
And that actually brings me to a question that I really wanted to ask, and then this will be the last question we'll talk about. When you think about the kinds of issues that tend to crop up in movies and books and whatnot about robots and other kinds of creatures, you get the theme of the question of rights, about how we treat them, etc. And as you say, and you're very right, in that science fiction is never really about the future. It just happens to be set there, right? It's always about kind of our present situation. In some ways, commenting on our current culture. And I wonder, do we get the sense that maybe readers or the public or the viewership is somehow making the connection, that connection that this story I'm watching, like District 9, in which I'm watching aliens being beat up on and treated like garbage and all kinds of awful things are done to them, am I making a connection to a real world in which people are beat up on and have awful things done to them? Do we get the sense that people are making that connection?
I think if the science fiction is done well enough, the theme and those connections come through. To give an example, the original V series in the 80s was a metaphor and a reflection on fascism, and it comes through loud and clear today, and it came loud and clear when I saw it back in the 80s. So I think if science fiction is done well, yeah, you can see those themes and see that, okay, robot rights are a metaphor for minority rights or gender politics or what have you. So yes, if it's done well, then the themes are an emergent property and the audience can see it.
Mm. Although I fascinatingly, when I look at things like robot rights, since it's something that it's about something that we create, and it's also about something that we initially see as something that's supposed to help us as opposed to be our equal, I more see parallels to animal rights in a weird way. I mean, if it's still legal for our military to deafen whales, and we're starting to get pretty sure that they've got some sort of intelligence to them, how are we going to treat a machine that we make who starts seeming more and more like us? So I don't know if most people make that connection, but to me, that's kind of where my mind goes, is something that we can look at as a lesser creature because it's not a human being like you would have with a racism analogy, because racism is about other human beings. But with robots, it seems to me more about things that you can initially look down on because they're not you, and trying to figure out then from there what sort of rights something that is not you deserves, when rights seem to be a human invention. So
yeah, I'm not familiar with the military deafening whales, but that's
sonar. Sounds... Look it up; it's disgusting. Sonar tests. It's actually they're terrible.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
That sounds awful.
It is.
Don't they have I guess they couldn't find the whales with sonar and not hurt the whale.
No, I mean, if they wanted to, you know, run around and give whales ear protection, that might work, but I don't think that's economically feasible.
I'm just trying to think, like, how, because if you were doing a test, it would seem to me like, you know, with the whales, if there's a way to find, because whales are big generally,
yeah,
speaking, to find the whales and go, okay, we can't do the test here because the whales are here, or like somehow we just make a little bit of noise and the whales will go away because they don't like noise, and then we can do the test.
It's amazing how far sound travels underwater. And sonar is designed to be insanely loud.
That's depressing.
And just noise pollution in general has reduced the ability of whales to communicate over long distances. This was discussed in Carl Sagan's Cosmos 30 years ago. He was talking about it, and I was shocked that we're basically cutting off whales' ability to communicate over long distances just because of just a plain noise pollution, to say nothing of the sonar tests.
That's depressing.
So robots basically have no hope.
Right, because just think of how we treat animals that most people would agree are majestic, wonderful creatures. I mean, most people like whales, even if they'd never hung out with one.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You couldn't find many people, like, walk down the street, like, do you want to punch a whale? And, like, not many people are going to openly admit to wanting to punch a whale. It's just not going to happen.
Now, punch a shark. Now, that's cool.
Right. They will punch a shark, right? Yeah. But that's because sharks are mean.
Yes.
Right? Whales are perceived to be these kinds of nice, friendly creatures, even though orcas are kind of evil, but orcas play with their food.
It's yeah.
Scary. But I mean, overall, whales are perceived to be nice creatures, whereas sharks are perceived to be evil. I think sometimes sharks get a bad rap because there have been so many movies about them being evil. And
yes.
The media, of course, plays it up every time someone gets bit by a shark because someone was dumb and swam in water that was marked as shark-infested.
Yeah. Whales, yeah. Not good with sexual boundaries.
Is that whales or dolphins?
Whales. Well, dolphins, too.
Let's not go there. Okay, so why don't you tell us a little bit about where people can find you, find your book. Do you have convention appearances coming up, Jennifer?
Yeah. Okay, well, first, jenniferpelland.com is my website. My novel is called Machine, and I also have a short story collection called Unwelcome Bodies. Both are available from Apex Publications. I'm going to be at PyCon in August, which is in Enfield, Connecticut, and AnthoCon in November in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I think I am going this year to Capclave in outside DC in October for the first time. So
cool.
And I am also a performing belly dancer, in case you're not a reader. So if you go to my website and then like sneakily find your way to my belly dance website from there, actually Facebook's better. I actually dance in restaurants around the Boston area and do shows and stuff. I'm not claiming to be great. I'm solidly mediocre, but I'm consistently mediocre. So, you know, that's something.
You didn't know that, Sean?
Oh, I knew that she claimed herself to be a belly dancer from her website. Yeah, I just didn't realize that was serious.
No, yeah. I perform, man.
That's awesome.
I've belly danced at conventions even, so...
That's awesome.
Combining my two loves. The first time I did it was at Aresia 3 years ago with someone I dance with. I usually dance alone, but we do it every now and then. And we wore Star Trek outfits and danced to Weird Al's White and Nerdy.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Aresia's geeky belly dance show was so much fun.
Now, quick question. Have you ever written a story in which the character is a belly dancer?
I just finally did and I sold it. So it's going to be in something called Unidentified Funny Objects. It's my belly dance time travel story.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
It took me years to figure out how to do it. Like I kept trying to figure out, you know, if you shimmy in space, what happens? And then I realized, forget it. Eventually I'll have to ask a physicist. But for now, I'll just set something on Earth and not have to worry about what gravity does when you do a hip bump.
This is awesome. So everybody should go check out Jennifer's website and check out her new book, Machine, from Apex. If you don't, I will steal Paul's German ancestry again, which I've done so many times at this point.
So go check out Jennifer Pelwin's book, please.
Yeah, because then he has to earn it back by watching a whole lot of bad movies.
Poor guy.
Yeah, yeah, that's how he gets it back. I don't know how I have this power. It's a very special gift.
Mm.
Stealing people's ancestry, yeah. Well, thank you, Jennifer, for being on our ridiculous show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
It was fantastic.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And we will see everybody, I don't know, at some point in some near future point. We're not professionals.
No.
So, all right. And goodbye.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.